Good morning, everybody. It is February the 8th, and this is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. And Mr. Cannon is with us from HEC, and he's going to kick it off.
Good morning.
Hi, Ben.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Great to be back in front of this committee where we spent so much time together almost a year ago. My role this morning is merely to introduce the panel that will follow. Oregon State University was directed by the legislature to provide a report to the Legislative Assembly for consideration during this legislative session regarding the implementation of programs and activities enabled by the $14 million funding increase for the statewide public services. Because that budget note is directed to OSU to provide the report, I will not endeavor to do so. Instead, we'll turn it over to our colleagues from Oregon State University. I think Dan Arp, the director of the Agricultural Experiment Station and dean of the Ag College there, will kick off that presentation. But we're very pleased to be carrying forward this $14 million increase that you all put into the OSU statewide's budget.
Madam Co-Chair.
Well, just a personal note, Mr. Cannon, I heard Representative Barton say something about not being able to sleep all night with the baby. He might need some advice.
Representative Kump, I will follow up with, Representative Barton. Got lots of that.
Okay, Mr. Arp, up next. Oh, they're all coming up.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody, the whole panel.
Whole family.
Okay. And I'm opening a work session on the report for the statewide public services.
Okay, thank you. Going to introduce ourselves first. My name is Dan Arp. I'm Dean of the College of Ag Sciences at Oregon State University.
I'm Scott Reed. I serve as Vice Provost for Outreach and Engagement and Director of the OSU Extension Service.
My name is Steve Tesh. I'm the Associate Dean for Research in the College of Forestry. I'm here representing Dean Thomas Manis, who's ill today.
And as Mr. Cannon said, we're really here to give you a report of where we're at with respect to the $14 million that the legislature generously made available to us in support of the statewide public services. So what we'd like to do is just follow through in this PowerPoint to give you a sense of where we're at in that process. So let me see, go to the... Wanted to start first by kind of laying out where our budget is to show you how this $14 million fits into the overall budget. If you look at the 2013-15 appropriation, remember or recall that we are the three separate organizations, but together we form the statewide public services program. So the experiment station, the extension service, and the forest research lab. In the 13-15 appropriation, we had just over $100 million with about a 3% continuing services level increase to that budget. We had about $104 million. But what we're really here to talk about is a report on the new and expanded initiatives, that $14 million that was made available by the legislature in support of new programs and new initiatives. So for the current biennium then, for the three statewide, the three organizations in the statewide, we have about $118 million. Before I move on to that, I did want to at least point out that $118 million that you see in the right-hand column of that slide does leverage about an additional $2 for every dollar, so about $242 million in additional funds that get leveraged with those statewide dollars. Those include federal funds, those include county funds, and those include industry and philanthropic support as well. So just before we move on, to let you know that we do that.
Madam Co-Chair.
I'm very curious, what type of competitive grants, can you give us an example for each category?
Yeah, so absolutely. So in the Ag Experiment Station, the competitive grants come, they're mostly federal grants. They come primarily from the United States Department of Agriculture, National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, Department of Energy.
But what if I was going to apply for a grant, which one would, I mean, just name something that a company or John Q. Public might want to apply for.
So we're actually talking about probably 200 different projects.
Okay.
So there are many different ones. An example might be funds to carry out wheat breeding. So to supplement the state funds to do breeding of new varieties that can be grown in Oregon. Another area might be to look at there's a large project that we have for Portland Harbor Superfund. So looking at how to measure the toxins that are down below in the sediments. Scott, you might have some examples from Extension.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, one of our recent grants in the Extension Service is to work on childhood obesity, and it's a multi-million-dollar, multi-year grant to look at modifying health behaviors.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
And again, we're really here today to talk to you about the $14 million that's on top of the other money that we have, but want to talk about how we're using that money. For the Ag Experiment Station and Extension, the majority of those new dollars are going into positions. Those are a combination of professorial positions, mostly professorial, some support positions as well, so supporting ongoing programs. Actually, about 40 positions have been approved for filling based on these dollars. So that's a remarkable lift in the number of positions that we have. Of those 40 positions, 8 of those are already filled. And we've placed a table in front of each of you so you can kind of see where we have filled some of those positions already.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Okay, so you out of 40 positions, you filled 8, and we're in month, 7 or 8 here in the biennium. Will you have some funds that won't be completely used out of this? That's not a good answer. Say, it's highly probable, but we're going to make sure we fund these as soon as possible. Yes.
So absolutely, we're in the process of filling these. It does take, of course, some time to get the search committees pulled together, get position descriptions written, get them out advertised, and then go through the interviews and things. We are making good progress on all of those. However, I think it's also important to understand that the dollars that that we're not spending until we hire are the dollars that we use to provide startup for each of these positions. So virtually all of these positions have startup costs. Those startup costs vary from relatively modest to what could be thought of as much as 3 or 4 times the annual salary of that individual. So it depends on whether this is a lab position or whether it's an extension field position. So all of those startup costs are different. And the dollars for those have to come from the savings until we fill these positions. Does that help?
Tremendously. It's just that as we budget for each biennium, and there's several areas, we're going to be hearing about early learning and some of that in the hubs also soon. And I know some of those hubs have been up and running from the beginning of the biennium, and some are still being put together. And so it's always a reminder to us to think about, well, where we are in the biennium.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As we were developing the support for this package, stakeholders were very supportive, state agencies, before it came to the legislature, we fashioned this package around 5 specific areas. One of those is water, another one's health and safety, another one's is basically economic development, 4th area is workforce development, and then finally working landscapes. And so we're going to march through those 5 areas, if that's okay with you, to sort of show you where we're at in each of those. And the first one is around water quality and quantity, very important areas to the state. And in that area, we are investing 6 positions. Those include 2 in the Klamath Basin area and 1 a statewide position around watersheds and water quality. Another one looking at fertilizer fate and transport. This, again, is a statewide position. Also looking at 22nd century ag technologies, this is about how to use water more efficiently, more effectively. How do we more efficiently use the irrigation water that we do have available? And then finally in this category, a nearshore fisheries biology position, looking at fisheries just off the coast.
And I'll pick it up here. I hope it's clear that these new positions are what I'll call surgical insertions into ongoing programs to take advantage of the already skill sets we have in the field. And while we're not into surgery, we are into health. And this slide illustrates 8 new positions around public health, food safety, and security. 2 of the positions are addressing small farms and community food systems. And while this program is headquartered in the College of Agricultural Sciences, it is heavily also embedded in the College of Public Health and Human Sciences, working with the combination of food and its growing, harvest, storage, marketing, consumption, and consumer decisions. 2 additional positions are in health extension, both on the southern coast and the central coast, and this is all around preventative health behaviors. Rather than cure disease, we think that we can help to create a kind of a culture of health in Oregon's communities. 2 additional positions in food safety and biology in the Ag Experiment Station. I skipped over the one on seafood innovation, which is going to also address coastwide issues. And then there's a position in multimedia communications, working with kind of the developing field of learning online, social media. And while this position is extension funded, it's in a unit that serves both the Experiment Station and the Extension Service.
So most of the positions, most of the work that we do, in fact, deals with economic development in one way or another. But a few of these positions are particularly relevant to economic development in the state. And some of those include a food system economics position, which will look at consumer trends, particularly around high-value foods and beverages in the state. Another one looking at brewing microbiology. So we have what is widely recognized as one of the top 2 brewing programs in the nation, and this will help develop that program even further. Position in plant biotechnology. Also one around vegetable and specialty seed cropping systems. This will be predominantly in the North Willamette Valley, where many of the specialty seeds and crops are produced in the state. And then another position in the Willamette Valley around dairy management, so helping to support what is our 3rd largest industry in the state, agricultural industry in the state. And then finally, a value-added business support on the South Coast. So those are some of the business development positions that we have.
By virtue of being university-based programs, the statewides intersect both citizen learners and enrolled students across the educational curriculum. And here's where we provide some kind of linkages and transitions for learners as they go through their lifetime. We have an innovation in the Extension Service that we've dubbed Open Campus that's trying to define what these 100-year-plus-old county extension offices should look like for the next 100 years. We've called it Open Campus, and it has a couple of interesting features, one of which looks at college and career pathways for youth. A second around degree completion. The Lumina Foundation says that there are about 550,000 Oregonians with some college credit and no degree. We think by helping them finish those degrees, largely they're place-bound, and we can use our growing online education opportunity to give them a credential that will improve their lives. And thirdly, Open Campus works on community economic development. In the 4-H Youth Development Program, which you know is one of the largest youth development programs in the state, we're focusing on another innovation we're calling Juntos, which is a whole family empowerment program for Latino families. So far, we've piloted it with 700 family members, about 360 K-12 youth who are struggling with low graduation rates. For those families that have come through Juntos, we have 100% high school graduation rate and 100% college growing rate. So we think that program is one that might deserve a little bit of expansion, even beyond what we've able to do so far. And finally, experiential learning. And here's where we match up the statewide public service faculty with our own OSU students and give them an in-community experience for benefits that go both ways.
Moving now to the final category, which is sustainable management of our working landscape. So between our 3 agencies, we cover much of the state working landscapes, including our forests, our croplands, our coastal areas. So lots of different areas that we work with. Yeah.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure if you were waiting till the end or if we were jumping in. Thank you. So on the last slide, educating the workforce of tomorrow. This just absolutely jumps out at me when you're talking about the open campus. Probably the only two more different counties I can think of would be Malheur and Multnomah. You've got Grant and Yamhill counties. Those are totally different counties, operate in totally different ways. So talk to me about how those two were chosen and what you're trying to learn, because that to me just is really a glaring difference. So there's got to be a reason.
Thank you. Those two counties represent kind of the next two in a series of expansions that we're kind of carefully moving open campus across the landscape. It was piloted in Crook and Tillamook counties several years ago. It has now grown to be in seven counties, and in all cases it's working with the appropriate community colleges. And so in this particular case, Grant County was kind of an underserved county, and we have found some resources and some partnerships that allowed us to take us a relatively small step into Grant County. In the case of Yamhill, Chemeketa Community College saw the virtues of working with especially the expanding Latino community there. We've got a variety of other counties in the queue, and we're working to build a set of readiness indicators so that we're putting what limited resources we have in their highest and best use. But in all cases, it's done in cooperation with the appropriate community college, the K-12 community, and then the kind of the business and leadership work in counties.
Go ahead.
I certainly don't know how it is now. I think years ago, as I think about Grant County's tax base, I don't know that Grant County pays into any community college's tax base. Maybe that's changed now. I know that a lot of the kids went to Treasure Valley. But when I think of Grant County, I don't think of a college associated with that county.
Yeah, so it could be Oregon State is the best game in town for Grant County.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do know that Eastern Oregon has had a presence in Grant County for quite a while, too. I just wanted to point out that, Ann and the Gorge is at a lot of meetings and doing a great job on the open campus. So I wanted to give her a shout out for doing a good job.
Thank you. Yes, she was a good hire.
Okay.
So working landscapes, interesting positions here. If we look first at the pollinator biology positions, there are actually three, and these came out of the recommendations of Governor's Task Force on Pollinator Biology prior to the previous session. Two of those are actually support positions, so they are what we call faculty research assistants who will carry out diagnostic work around pollinators, and then one will be an extension position that will be developing and disseminating information on best practices around pollinator biology and pollinator health. Two positions dealing with horticultural crops, in particular weed and around weed management, one of those out at Hermiston and one that will be based in Corvallis but doing statewide work. The next one is also a very interesting position, and that this one came more than most from the stakeholders who pushed for this position. So this is a position around slug management, which is particularly important here in the Valley, but not limited to the Valley. So slugs are a problem in many parts of the state and in different industries, including, surprisingly, Christmas trees. So you find this as an issue. And so because of the strong support of the stakeholders, this is one of the positions that came through in the package. And this is an example of where we have the search ongoing. Just last week, the three candidates were on campus and did their interviews. So we'll be able to move pretty quickly with this position. Next, we have two positions around IPM, and I apologize, we should have spelled that out. That's integrated pest management. So that's what IPM is about. So it's a way of making decisions about best practices around use of pesticides, when best to apply them, what sort of tools do you have to help inform when you use them, how much you use, and what types you use. And so building that support across the state. And then finally, a coastal marine management position in Clatsop County. And actually, sustainable management is the largest position or largest category into which we're placing positions. So we have a second slide showing, and I'm going to skip the first one and go to the livestock range management position in Umatilla County, and then also the range ecology sustainability positions as well. So range ecology, so this is an area where because of the sage grouse and its potential listing, it was not listed as an endangered species, but there's now still a tremendous amount of work to do in terms of supporting the ranchers in their plans for how to take care of the sage grouse.
Representative Taylor has a question.
Thank you, Co-Chairman Rowe. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the timber harvesting forestry, what's happening there.
So I'm going to, yeah, absolutely. And what I'm going to do now is pass it to Steve Tesh, and he's going to talk about those two positions
okay,
and
great.
About
Thank
how
you.
They're going to use the forest research. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Good morning. You should know that we have a model forestry extension program.
And we need
in
you
North
on
America.
The record.
Pardon me?
I need your name and title.
Oh, I'm sorry. Steve Tesh, College of Forestry.
Thank you.
Representative Comp, Chair Monroe. I'm pleased to tell you about the forestry positions. Again, I want to emphasize the quality of our forestry extension positions. It's a model nationally. We have wrapped up two searches, the two that are identified here, one statewide and one Lane County. Just last week, so it adds to the eight that Dan identified as filled. One in Lane County will begin work on April 4th, and then the timber harvesting extension specialist will begin work in the summer. And it's really terrific to refill these positions. Both of these were foundational positions for many, many years and have been vacant for a number of years now. So it's terrific to have these refilled.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. The reason I'm asking is I'm just curious, within these two positions or at OSU with the Forestry Extension Program, what kind of work is being done in research on detection and prevention of fires? The reason I mention it is because you're probably aware of the fact that the Department of Forestry is having a large-scale work group on how to address our forest fire problems here in Oregon. And I think we've learned, obviously, Oregonians, industry, and other folks, that no one's really liking the brown forests and wanting to detect and prevent the fires from happening in the first place. And I'm just wondering if this is something that's being worked on at OSU at all, or is that just simply out of your mission?
Oh, no, absolutely. Fire is a key part of our academic and research program
uh-huh.
in the College of Forestry. We've just added to our capacity by hiring a new faculty member who can work both on fire-related issues and the landscape management aspects of fire. So as we look at the evolving climate change challenges and the likely impacts on drought and insect and disease, working to identify silvicultural strategies, forest management strategies that can improve the resilience of our forests in anticipation of those changes, key part of our research program. We work closely with the Pacific Northwest Research Station of the Forest Service
mm-hmm.
and with the Oregon Department of Forestry in crafting that research mm-hmm. and outreach agenda.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So my role now is also to follow up and talk a little bit about how we're deploying our resources. And we've done things a little bit differently. We are concentrating on a major research initiative. Could you push the button for me, please? So we've targeted our funds at learning more about marbled murrelets. This was a key natural resource forest management issue for the state of Oregon. And for those of you that may not remember, the marbled murrelet is a small seabird about the size of a robin, spends much of its life in the ocean, but it nests in older forests as much as 50 miles inland. So it spends its night on the ocean, and then at some point flies inland to nest and to roost. And we don't know as much as we need to about managing for that species and how to conserve habitat and so forth. The Elliott State Forest would be a key point of concern with respect to this bird. So we've worked closely with stakeholders to identify this as a primary issue. We've at this point in the biennium have assembled a strong science team led by the College of Forestry, an experienced marble murrelet researcher from the College of Agricultural Sciences, and a seabird expert from the USGS Wildlife Co-op Unit. This team is hard at work in organizing a plan of research. It's synthesizing what we already know, building on the systematic evidence review that was completed by the Oregon Department of Forestry in the last year. And we have a goal, if we can capture enough of these birds and track them to their habitat, to build better landscape management planning tools. So this team is consulting with science experts that have done this work in British Columbia and Alaska and California, so that we have the best possible science plan moving ahead. We're looking at the newest and best technology that involves satellite tags that are light enough that can be placed on a bird that also dives as much as 50 feet or more beneath the ocean as it goes fishing for its food. And then these tags need to be able to stay attached when they fly inland and fly and land in trees. So some significant technology challenges, and there are some advances that we hope to deploy. We're working with stakeholders as we develop the science plan to make sure we're asking the right questions and framing this in the appropriate manner. And let's see, I'm not sure what the next slide shows. Can you?
That's just clear.
Okay, back. So the slide that I thought might be here is one that shows a raft in the surf at night. And if you think about how you capture these birds, for many years our approach has been to watch birds fly by in the forest and try to follow them to a nest. Well, that leads us to an approach that identifies habitat based on where we look for them. Our new approach is to try to capture birds in the surf at night from a small raft while the birds are asleep, attach the transmitters to them, and then follow them wherever they might go. And this gets us, this provides us with the opportunity to really find out what the habitat is that's used broadly by these animals.
And on my screen, I can see that raft. For some reason, it's not on right up here, but it's in Olas.
Great. So the science team has got a standing offer to anybody that would like to join in one of those rafts to help capture these birds at night. So one
when
of the
I retire.
Yeah, okay, great. So one of the challenges is that this is an El Nino year, and marble murrelets tend not to breed in El Nino years. So we're using this first year of the biennium to develop our sampling methods, do practice the technology, and be really ready to go when we hope next year is a more normal year and these birds are ready to breed. It doesn't help us if we find a way to attach transmitters, but then these birds don't go in and successfully breed in here.
Why do they not breed during an El Nino year?
My understanding.
Personal question.
Yes,
Senator Monroe. My understanding is that the ocean conditions
do warm
change, and that the food source for the birds declines. And okay. So again, they're feeding on small bait fish and that sort of thing. If they're not in real healthy condition, they don't breed successfully.
Okay.
So I think this is a work in progress. We're working to finalize the budget and the expenditures associated with this. We believe this is a long-term effort, but we built in some checkpoints. So if we go through this first effort and we're unable to cost-effectively use new technology to capture these birds and get the numbers we need to have a robust sample size, then we have some checkpoints and we may redeploy those resources to other issues, one of which might be more work in forested watershed issues. But we're working with stakeholders, we're working with the college's advisory committee, and we're very pleased to be able to tackle this very challenging research initiative with these resources. So thank you.
And our final slide is a companion piece to the table that identifies each position that we distributed to you. You'll see that the staffing model that the statewides use emphasizes boots on the ground. That's backstopped by selective positions located on the Corvallis campus that themselves have statewide responsibilities, frequently in curriculum development and information support to those that deliver the information on the ground. And you'll note that while the spreadsheet identifies 46 positions, we have 40 in active search status. There are six shown as pending. And to your point, Co-Chair Comp, earlier, those shown as pending will be filled funds permitting. And so we are developing the opportunity to move on them, and will only after we've kind of settled and negotiated the salary and the startup costs for the others. But we will use every last dollar, you know, in filling positions over time.
That's a wise choice.
Yeah. and there's just the final point. While the map and the dots identify precise points on the map, our people have responsibilities that are frequently multi-county, given that we have been forced to spread people around. And so we believe that we are really working as best as we can to satisfy the needs and the geographic distribution of issues, broad as they are, for all the statewide. So that concludes our report. Thank you for the opportunity this morning.
Thank you. Any additional questions? I didn't hear anything about GMO. It seems to be a hot topic, and I wondered if you do any research in GMO and if you have anything to add there to our discussion. There's actually some legislation that some of us will be dealing with, and so I'm interested in learning more.
So do we do anything with GMO? So we don't have any of our plant breeders currently working to produce genetically modified organisms as varieties that they would release. However, most of our plant breeders use the techniques that lead to genetically modified organisms in order to study the plants and in order to make new varieties more rapidly. So this is the entire area of bioinformatics and genomics, where you take advantage of that information to learn about the varieties and where the traits are that you want to move into a new variety. So how do you bring those traits together? So we're certainly using it that way, but we're not engaged in currently. It's not to say it won't happen in the future, but at least currently, none of the plant breeders are producing varieties that would be released as GMOs. Part of the reason for that is that most of what we do is in the area of specialty crops. So we have a hops breeder, we have vegetable breeders, those aren't large enough to support the effort that currently needs to go through to bring one of those genetically engineered product to market. Simply not big enough to be able to do that.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. You have research scientists that are working on the spread through genetics, you know, the windborne, yeah, other kinds of stuff, in certain parts of the state. There are researchers working on the GMO question about whether they can coexist in the valley. Is that correct?
Right.
So they do have those researchers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else for these gentlemen? Thank you very much. Katie Fast, are you here?
Good morning, Chairman Rowe and members of the committee. For the record, excuse me, Katie Fast with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'm very pleased to be here to talk about the investment made last session and give a stakeholder's perspective of the $14 million. I think looking back at the last legislative session, that $14 million in the statewides of additional revenue was probably the most important investment that was made for rural Oregon. These programs are the research and development for the natural resource sectors. We have over 220 agricultural commodities in the state, and these programs touch every one of those across the state with that statewide presence. The stakeholders are grateful for the way the deans and their staff are engaging them in the development of the new research projects and many times in the hiring process. As an example, the slug position that was mentioned, they brought in many of the farmers that are dealing with lost crops from slugs to come in and participate in the interview process and the reviews and give their input in to who they felt like the best candidate would be.
Additionally, another example, there was questions about the delayed hiring and how those resources were being used. In one area, those resources are being used to get the pollinator lab up and running. That was a big priority for stakeholders and many people in this body. So that's one way how those savings are being used. So when those staffing positions are made, those folks are have the resources and the technical, lab things ready to go. The researchers that we work with are tackling very complicated environmental issues, and those are solutions that can be found in a lab. They're found many times in Mother Nature, which is unpredictable, and they're dealing with the same issues in their research that their farmers and foresters that they are working with are dealing with. And so these are not projects that can be solved in a biennium. And it's very important that this investment continues on so that those projects can continue on or they can move to step two, which is important for the whole economy of our agriculture and forestry sectors. Also looking at the 17 and 19 biennium, we'd like to see the continuing service level calculated and what the real costs of PERS and healthcare and other roll-ups are, and not kind of a number that's picked. And so, a real substantial continuing service level that reflects the costs that Oregon State's bearing and won't be then, if it's too low, kind of eating away at those research projects and those staffing positions. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie, I just wondered if you wanted to expand on the technical things part of the... Yeah.
We could spend a lot of time, Mr. Huffman, on pollinators, so we can talk later about mites that are threatening our bee populations and the diagnostic lab that's getting developed, and there's probably better people than I to talk about those details here.
Okay. Well, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Siebert, I'm sorry.
Bender.
Well, you gave me a promotion in my intelligence, that's for sure. Members of the committee, I would LFO recommends acknowledging receipt of the report you just heard on the statewide public service programs at Oregon State University.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
I move that we accept the recommendation as stated by LFO staff.
The motion is to accept the recommendation, is there any discussion of the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, we'll need somebody to carry this recommendation to full.
I would love to.
Madam Co-Chair will carry to full. Okay.
I love agriculture.
Of course. Beer and bees and all that stuff.
Well, no, I was thinking of planting potatoes and peas and onions.
Yes, yep. Done a little of that, too. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, the second item on yours is an informational hearing on Senate Bill 418. That bill required this report, and I think Mr. Cannon is taking the lead again on this, among others. And it should be noted that Representative Johnson will likely be here too to talk about this item. Keep in mind, Senate Bill 418 had included a $6.9 million special purpose appropriation to the emergency board. This report lays out a work group that was established by HEX, their recommendations for the use of those funds. With that, I would suggest Mr. Cannon come to the table to lead off. And this is not an action item today, but somewhere before the end of session, there'll be the decisions will be made on the $6.9 million and how to spend it.
Ben.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. While we're getting the PowerPoint pulled up, I'll make some preliminary remarks. As Doug noted, this report is part of the requirements that you established for us under the adoption of Senate Bill 418. Again, as Doug said, that bill set aside almost $6.9 million for us to come back and make a recommendation to this legislature, the 2016 legislature, on how to spend in order to support successful student transitions from high school to post-secondary and success in college. And I am just so pleased and excited to bring this report to you today because it reflects, I think, something pretty unique in this body, which is a true multi-sector effort to address what is really a bedeviling problem in education, this student transition, successful student transition from K-12 to higher ed. The work group that we've put together included representatives of K-12, of ESDs, of community colleges, of public universities, of organizations that support student access and completion. And I think you'll see in them a holistic approach to supporting students in their transition from high school to college and in success in college. So it's really an exciting opportunity, I think, for this legislature to make a sizable impact on student success. So our work group included 24 folks. I mentioned some of the organizations that they represented. I'm really in the sort of luxurious position of only having to bring forward this work on their behalf, and I'll do so at a very high level. You'll hear from some of the folks who actually participated and led in that work group and can address, I think, really the details. I will note at the outset that we looked at these as likely one-time dollars, okay, so this $6.8 million, which meant that we suggested, the commission and I suggested to the work group, that they should be focused on initiatives that could support building capacity for the work, but not building capacity in the sense of, for the most part, adding staff, adding positions, but rather building the tools, supporting the professional development, supporting the knowledge and understanding and learning of the professionals engaged in this work for the long term, but to do so with one-time dollars. So that was a sort of the way that we launched this at the outset, and that's reflected in the recommendations that we're bringing back to you today. So the recommendations fall in four categories. There's a report that our commission has adopted that lays this out over about 24 pages, and then there's several charts that summarize it, and I will provide a summary here today. But there are four categories for the proposed investments that we're bringing forward, and I'll go through each of them just at a very high level. The first really relates to advising and improving the success and connections of our advisors and counselors in high schools and colleges. The second relates to supporting students in the development of a plan and purpose for their educations, particularly their post-secondary educations, but beginning that early. The third category relates to developmental education that takes place primarily in community colleges, and career pathways work that also are community college-led. And finally, the fourth relates to successful development of math pathways for students. Again, really organized around where college students, college and university students get, but reaching back into K-12. So I'll go into a little more detail about each of those. So on the counseling, and we've got this under the heading of alignment, counseling and advising, we're recommending a $1.1 million investment here into cross-sector academic advising and career counseling components that are developed and provided collaboratively by secondary and post-secondary advisors and counselors. So envision essentially a summer summit to occur later this year, regionally led activities that bring together high school and college advisors and counselors to better understand each other's work, in particular to better understand the opportunities that are available to students in post-secondary education, workforce training, other activities.
I hate to interrupt, Ben, but are you looking at, when you do the summit, are you going to ask individuals or school districts to bring a cluster of coordinated people?
Representative Kump, Co-Chair, this work would be led through primarily through our regional achievement collaboratives, organized, our RACs, developed on a organized on a regional basis. They would be working closely with school districts, who likely would be identifying the team of counselors who would participate from K-12, sitting at a table with, ultimately, college counselors. Again, we appreciate the fact that at both levels, high school and college, there are not enough counselors and academic advisors, and that is a serious issue. Our ratios are simply too large, and you know that too. But we also appreciate that the few counselors who we have, the too few counselors who we have in high schools and in college, need better support in understanding the options that are available to students. Those include college options. They include other options for students beyond secondary education. And this initiative is designed to really build that knowledge, share that information across those two sectors.
Will you have ongoing meetings throughout the year to keep them engaged?
Yes. Senator Monroe, Representative Kump, this initiative would support not only that summer convening, but a set of ongoing collaborative activities that would bring those two sectors together on a regional basis. The summer convening statewide, the regional work would continue on through the year. The second category of proposed investments is the largest. We're recommending $3.9 million of investment that's organized around the belief, the understanding that students are more successful in this transition when they have a plan and purpose. And we so often focus, and some of these recommendations focus on getting the structure right, alignment, and integration of our K-12 and higher ed structures. In the final analysis, the student's plan and purpose has a lot to do with whether or not they're successful. But there are things that the system can do to support students getting that plan and purpose. Oregon has had requirements around student career planning and post-secondary education planning, K-12 students doing that planning for many, many years, and a lot of work and investment has gone in over the decades around this. I would characterize, and we've got quite a bit more detail in the report, but I would characterize these recommendations as an updating, a bringing into the 21st century, if you will, of the tools that school districts in particular deploy in to support students' development of plans. So,
Co-Chair.
I have to go back and look at my own personal experience on this, and I don't know if Senator Roblin's had experience with this at a high school level, but there have been many attempts over the last 30 years and dollars put into CIS, Career Information Systems, things like AVID, and the reality is, no matter how hard some of the leadership or the counselors work, there just isn't enough time in a student's day to do these things. And so I love the intention here, and it does say intentional student plan, but I'm concerned about reality.
Representative Kump, Mr. Co-Chair, that may be a point that some who are behind me and will follow me want to address. I'll only note that several of these recommendations are really to, again, update, for example, the career information system tool that the vast majority of our K-12 school districts pay for and belong to today, but is not getting sort of adequate deployment to students. So by updating expanding that license to include cell phone and tablet capability for students and for counselors. Likewise, on the sort of mentoring side, on the college side, we're it's a very modest investment that would help us do more email and social media outreach to students, updating the ODE's educational plan and profile requirement to create a user-friendly tool on tablets and cell phones. So again, it's these one-time investments designed to breathe life into, I think, a real long-time effort by the part of the, on the part of the state and school districts and colleges to really put planning, student planning, at the heart of advising.
Just a quick follow-up, Ben. It's been, again, my experience, until you have parent involvement and parents understanding that these tools are out there, particularly at the middle level, I am wondering also about, with technology, we do have the opportunity, are some of these tools in multiple languages? Or are they all English?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I don't know the answer to that and would suggest that somebody who's behind me can.
Okay, because if we have them in multiple languages, from Mandarin to Spanish to Chinese, it might help.
Okay.
The third category I want to move along fairly quickly is focused around improving developmental education practices at community colleges. You know that the majority of our high school students who arrive at a community, our recent high school graduates, I should say, who arrive at a community college, test into developmental education, typically in math, and that means that they are not enrolled in at the outset in college credit-bearing courses in math or writing. There has been a lot of work over the last couple of years at the community college level to improve the way that we place students and assess students for developmental education, as well as the way that we support students within developmental education. One very promising model for improving developmental ed is a co-requisite model where students are engaged simultaneously or enrolled simultaneously in a college credit-bearing course as well as the developmental education course. And so they're simultaneously getting extra support, but they're also taking that college-level math or English language arts writing course. This would provide professional development support to community colleges and faculty in order to advance that and other promising models in developmental ed. It would also support continued work on career pathways. These are stackable, short-term programs that lead to certificate or can lead to degree. They reach back into the high schools through dual credit, and we see an opportunity to really advance that through a $600,000 investment that would be a portion of this this component. The fourth and final I'm particularly excited about, if there is a single academic barrier to college success, it is math, and I noted it in the context of developmental ed. Our commission, our colleges and universities have, over the last year, established a new math pathway for students, degree-seeking students, and particularly those who don't intend to seek a STEM-related major. It's a pathway that includes a college-level math course and is appropriate for has been determined appropriate for a transfer degree to an Oregon university, but it's not organized around college algebra, which is sort of the gateway to calculus course. It is a quantitative literacy course that's more appropriate for and more useful for students in non-STEM related, who are likely to seek non-STEM related degrees. This proposed investment of $650,000 will ensure that faculty are organizing their work and their thinking, including their advising, around the non-STEM organized math pathway, There is also a need and an opportunity to connect this work back down to K-12. So we're advising and supporting students in the right math work as 11th and 12th graders in particular. So, again, I think a real key to ensuring student success in higher education. You'll note here some of the barriers that were identified by the work group as they explored this topic. They include a couple of items that I haven't noted in my summary of the initiatives or proposed initiatives. One of them is data, and there is funding in here that would support the ability of high schools to better understand where their graduates go and how successful they are, which we see as a particularly important responsibility. You'll see here that the dollars are, and we can provide, you know, greater levels of detail as appropriate as you consider these investments, but dollars are would be distributed in many of these tranches to the RACs, to the Regional Achievement Collaboratives, who have some capacity and some experience in pulling together these cross-sector groups on a regional basis. Several of the initiatives and tools that I've described would be led out of my office, and in particular the Office of Student Access and Completion, the OSAC portion of HEC, with some of the planning and mentoring tools that have been described, and some of the dollars would be distributed to community colleges. We propose ensuring that a portion of these dollars are reserved to permit us, and I think it's $50,000, but a modest portion would be reserved to ensure that we are able to assess the impact of this work, and you see some of the outcomes that we would be striving to measure. And finally, and to conclude my portion of the presentation, I want to note here the representatives of various organizations, K-12, ESDs, higher ed, who participated and really led in the development of the recommendations that you see today. It's, again, a pretty unique opportunity to bring together these sectors, and I expect that regardless of what you choose to do with the investments, a lot was learned, a lot was gained just amongst these participants through talking with each other, which doesn't happen as much as it should, but there's a great deal of excitement for it, and I think you'll hear that in the comments that follow my presentation.
Okay.
I am complete. I am finished.
Of course. Thank you, Ben.
That's a really odd time to come in to a room.
I am never complete. None of us are, but I am finished with my presentation.
So now we're going to the really smart people behind you.
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
Come on up. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair, Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Dorn, and I'm the School to Career Coordinator for David Douglas High School, as well as our district.
Biggest and the best high school in the state,
you're right. I'm glad I have a fan already. I coordinate our career technical programs, oversee dual credit opportunities, build relationships with our business partners, and work very closely with our college and career center staff to ensure that students and their families are provided with one-on-one college financial aid and scholarship assistance. Over the last 4 months, I participated in the Senate Bill 418 work group. The funding that's available can be used to achieve the following objectives and make post-secondary education more accessible for all of Oregon's students. Through my personal experience working at, again, our state's largest high school, I'm thankful to share my thoughts on the importance of these efforts. First, we need to invest in creating a bridge between K-12 and community college. Local areas should be encouraged to develop resources and pathways that are specific to their community. I believe that my colleagues in both K-12 and post-secondary are experts in knowing how to best help their students. However, what we lack is time. Counselors, career guidance staff, and all of the other key players need to come together to build effective bridges between K-12 and post-secondary. We must be intentional in our efforts so that students and families are aware of the supports and resources available as they transition from high school to post-secondary. It was mentioned the importance of parents. I meet with a lot of parents, and sometimes they're not involved. But one of the biggest reasons why they aren't involved is because they were not successful as students. They're intimidated, they're scared, and when I meet with them, what their biggest fear is they don't want to see their students go through the same things that they did. They don't want to see their students fail. And so it's very important that we provide and show them the opportunities and the ways to transition to post-secondary. As the leaders in education and as the primary communicators with families, it's our responsibility to be the experts. We also need to revitalize our current statewide tools, such as CIS and the Personalized Education Plan. I often speak to high school freshmen about their plans, and I ask them, what do you want to do when you grow up? You know, what are your plans? I often hear doctor, new one is a social media expert, and the most popular and frequent response I hear now is video game tester. It's very true. My follow-up question, what are your plans to achieve that goal, is often met with blank stares. Thankfully, there are many tools available that students in Oregon can use. Oregon CIS is an online system of information that helps students learn about themselves and plan for their future. The Personalized Education Plan, a requirement for all high school students, is most valuable when it's used not as a four-year plan that students update once a year, but a roadmap that includes a variety of shortcuts and scenic routes that are specific to each student.
And Sarah, these mics are really sensitive. Mm-hmm. If you stay about 6 inches away from
better?
It does better.
Okay, wonderful. We must meet students where they are, not where we expect them to be, and serve as a helpful guide as they make important decisions. Our students are very tech savvy. They surpassed me long ago. We must use this to our advantage. We need to invest in updating these valuable tools to make them more engaging, available in different languages, and accessible on mobile devices. If we truly believe that students should explore their passions and create their own paths, we need to provide accessible tools that can change and follow them from middle school to high school to post-secondary. And finally, we need to continue investing in targeted supports. Over the past few years, I've seen thousands of students who've benefited from targeted supports such as Gear Up, Future Connect, Avid, College Possible, and many others. These groups provide students with access to resources that are focused on overcoming challenges and barriers. The supports not only arm students with academic confidence and awareness about post-secondary options, but most importantly, they provide a place where students are accepted and they feel like they belong. When setbacks occur, the leaders are available for encouragement and coaching. The targeted supports are truly essential in helping students learn to persevere, to not give up, to keep on achieving their goals. The students that walk down our halls today are very different than the students that sat in my class 10 years ago. Our population is much more diverse. Each student brings with them a unique background and culture. However, these students share three very important traits. They're creative, they're innovative, and they have a desire to make things better. Today's students are tomorrow's computer programmers, lawyers, entrepreneurs, and community leaders. But more importantly, they are our problem solvers. We owe it to them to provide systems that will support the resources they need to be successful. Thank you so much.
Are there questions? Thank you. Who's next?
Good morning, members of committee. Hello, my name is Daisy Tran. I'm a senior at West Salem High School, and I live in West Salem, Oregon. I am glad to be here to talk about how important the PEP has been in helping me figure out my future plans. I come from a family that values education, and this is why I think this Senate bill is so important. So the PEP is the Personal Education Plan, and I was introduced to the PEP in the ninth grade when the counselors came to my classroom and explained the process about how it can help with college one day. And since my freshman year, I've completed the necessary steps for each grade level. I use the PEP as a plan to keep track of what I've done so far in high school and am now using the information I collected each year for applying to colleges and scholarships. I have learned that the PEP helps keep track of my classes, my activities, my achievements, and many more. It is a good tool to use to help plan for the future because it helps you think more in depth about what you want to do in life. Because of my work on the PEP, I learned how to use the CIS website, which is the Career Information Systems website. The CIS website is relevant by helping me apply for some OSAC scholarships. I was able to transfer all of my activities, honors, awards, and achievements, and it was directly from my PEP onto my OSAC application, which saved me a lot of time and gave me more time to apply for other scholarships. The other part of the PEP that was very helpful was the activities we completed, like the interest locator. For this activity, I had to rate the level of importance my work environment was to me, and then gave me possible career options based on my results. My plan after high school is to study accounting at Oregon State University, and the PEP has helped me in my plan by giving me information about this profession and the benefits it could provide. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to come and talk to you about the PEP and CIS.
Thank you, Ms. Tran. Other questions? Okay, next.
Good morning. My name is Jim Ustrom. I work at Chemeketa Community College and currently the Vice President of Instruction and Student Services. I served on, as well on the Senate Bill 418 Task Force. But I want to speak to, I come with a lot of experience. In, we implemented the Chemeketa Scholars Program, which worked with students directly from high school at a 3.5 grade point average. I know the struggles they had. We've had a lot of work with College Credit Now, the Willamette Promise, other areas of accelerated learning in high schools. I know the problems those students have had in transitioning and what they might need from that perspective. And I come here to support some of the pieces that specifically I want to talk about, the advising piece and the need for a better collaborative system between high schools and colleges, and then also the math redesign and developmental ed redesign, because those seem to be the stumbling blocks to many students' paths to success in their academic goals. While a focus may be on the Oregon Promise student, I want to mention this too, and on others, it will focus, it will turn its look on all students in community colleges and universities as we move forward. And that's what I think is so exciting about some of these pieces here. We know it's about, again, we mentioned about the lack of personnel, but at the same time, the need to bring people together can revitalize that. So we know this as a one-time investment. That's how we approached it, and that's where we're looking at how we could gear up and expand the good work that's been underway by high schools and community colleges and universities. So number one, the strong academic advising and career counseling, it may be the greatest contributed to student success. And we have, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of experimentation with what we're doing with working with high school counselors and trying to enhance the knowledge base of what a student needs to be successful in college. Some of the issues that come up without a strong system of communication is even down to the point of students are being encouraged to take more accelerated learning in high school, more credits. What they come to, I had a student just this last year, a Chemeketa Scholar, 4.0 grade point average. He came with 30 credits of high coming into college or high school, but six of them are not going to be eligible for anything that he's going to do for his degree or certificate, or whether it's a degree he wants to transfer. But he just wanted to take everything that was available, and he didn't have anyone advising him about the appropriate ones to take. That's key. I think we've done some good work in the last year or two around trying to bridge that and getting into the high schools better. The concept that Ben talked to about this composite of high school and college counselors and advisors meeting and statewide to develop what those systems would be instrumental. We have some good little pilots everywhere where things are going, but this would help us to expand it across the state. I just see the impact on the individual students. I spoke to the Chemeketa Scholars program that where we had students with a 3.5 grade point average, and yet they still weren't at a level in math, and they were really placed into college level math. They were replacing, so we reduced that qualification, and instead of placing at a 100 level math, you have to place at math 95 in order to be part of the Chemeketa Scholars program. What we've been doing is another pilot that the state's been doing around math redevelopment or math redesign is really looking at those the pathways that students were wanting to take and really getting a math program such as Math 98, which we're doing for non-STEM students, we're piloting this year, looking at how we can do that to better meet the needs of students and keep them out of the I don't want to say anything bad here, the world of developmental ed where they might languish for years as they're trying to go through everywhere from math 20 to math 40, 60, 70, 95, trying to get to 105 or 115. So looking at things differently, this also leads into the whole redevelopment or a redesign of developmental ed also. And so we're looking at how to accelerate that. We Ben talked about the collaborative, having classes linked or the even the instruction embedded in some of the other programs also. So all this takes coming together, and I think that's the piece that I'm excited about what's in this plan, that it really would let us jump off from some of the good work that's been underway in the last year or two and really expand it statewide. So really from the student perspective, I think we have inhibitors in place that we could get rid of, but it really does take time and effort to do that, and that's the purpose of this one-year request.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Okay, we've got two more people we need to hear from. Hilda, and then Rep. Johnson. Thank
you. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
While they're coming up, a question, maybe you're Senator Roblin. the status of the fifth year bill. It just happened to dawn. It pertains to all this.
It does, actually. I was thinking about that in a number of different ways. Currently, we are working on some amendments with that particular bill. My expectation is that it will not affect anybody who can apply for and receive the promise. So it wipes out all the people with above 2.5 and it does some other stuff. It also limits school districts, eventually cuts down the amount of money that we get per one. Right now it says that we want to have a study through HEC. And there's a cost for that, so it'll probably come to Ways and Means of identifying who those kids really are, what's happening with them, and how they're moving forward. And so that by 24 years from now, or 3 years from now, they'll have a recruit, so we'll know exactly how many kids, what it costs. It's open to whole school district. The expectation is that with the sidebars that are on the current amendment, it will cut it to half the current kids that are using it for the whole state. So they expect it to be about 450 kids statewide if they want any school district could get into it. But it has some requirements that state districts have to do with regard to counseling and other kinds of stuff, meeting with kids at least twice a month, doing some of the things that we've known need to happen. I think it's a pretty good attempt at getting it under control, figuring out what it actually costs, and then having a decision in the next couple of years from us about how to fund that appropriately as opposed to the fund that is in right now. So I think it's come a long ways. There's still a conversation about it because there are people who don't think that any money should come out of the state school fund to support this kind of a program. The individual statistics from schools, including Woodburn and others, were that about 80% of the kids that go from in that program first year go on to the second year, which is about four times better than the current system that we have where kids go out and don't complete. So I see a lot of really positive things embedded in it. It's going to be a much more difficult group of kids because we're taking the kids under 2.5 and we're giving them some requirements. It doesn't allow you to have a diploma and move forward like was happening before with a whole bunch of kids, so it cuts that part out. So from my perspective, it over the next couple of years, we'll have the information to make really good decisions. And I commend all of the school districts who have been using it for being a part of the conversation about how to cut a whole lot of their kids out, because they're going to expect to use the Oregon Promise for most of the kids and support them in which they would. And that's why, from their experiences, they would say what we're talking about here is really important, because it is more the supports they get that makes it successful than it is about getting the access to it, which is just what the other ones are. So I think this is a really important conversation for ongoing and to keep the whole thing working. We'll also put a deal in it if over time we decide that we want to move Oregon Promise down from 2.5, say, to 2.25 or something, that goes down too, so schools can't use both. Kids can only use one program. So I am confident that what we are having a conversation about is a good movement. At the same time, there are still concerns that people have about having a certain certain ending date and so on and so forth. I think that's better to have the conversation the next full session, after we get the program going and making sure that the kids recognize that it's not them. Their school districts may have taken a way of doing it that some other people don't like, but we're going to support the kids that are making good choices about where they want to go. So that's where it's at right now.
And Representative Huffman, I have a strong interest in this, and have been having conversations not only with Senator Roblin, but also with Sarah Gelser and others. And my feeling very strongly is that we need to find an end date to the use of the basic school fund for programs that are beyond high school. That's not the intention of having a basic school fund. Basic school fund is never enough. Republicans and Democrats are always looking for ways of enhancing it, and yet this program has been funded out of that fund, which means it's not available for regular K-12 programs. So we're working on it, and I'm not ignoring it. I'm having conversations with all the necessary people, and we've already caucused on it once on our side, and as soon as we have any finality, I will certainly involve you in this whole committee.
Currently has a work session for Wednesday.
Okay. Very good.
And because of some of the new requirements have been put in about keeping track of how it goes and asking HEC to do some of that finding where the kids are and how they're doing, probably we'll have to go to Ways and Means.
Good. So it may very well come here.
Or Hilda. Capital construction. Good morning.
Good morning.
Co-chairs Monroe and Kump and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be back with you. Once again, we are focused on the importance of those transitions for students grades 11 through 14. For the record, my name is Hilda Roselli, College and Career Readiness Director in the Chief Education Office. And I'm here this morning to provide an additional P20 perspective as you consider the recommendations from the Senate Bill 418 work group with which I had the pleasure of working. Our office, of course, brings a unique vantage point that spans the learning continuum, as you know. We leverage this perspective to coordinate the cross-agency work and the cross-sector partners that are needed to really work towards shared goals around supporting our key student outcomes. And as you know, the critical alignment of this work and the coordination that's needed to support those students across grades 11 through 14 is absolutely paramount to the governor's vision of ensuring that every student graduate from high school with a plan for their future, whether that's going into post-secondary education, a certification program, or some other job training or the world of work. Deepening the coordination between our educational entities and partners, as recommended in this report, really represents a critical opportunity for us as a state to eliminate many of the existing barriers that impede students from progressing in their education. You heard about, from Daisy, a system that's working, but our analysis and research done by Education Northwest showed that we have relatively few schools that have been able to take advantage of the state's unfunded plan, and they haven't been trained on it. They haven't really had a bevy of tools available to use to support them. I also want to just call out that this work is positioned in a larger landscape. As you remember, the 15th legislative session, you all made historic investments in our K-12 and our post-secondary partners. And a lot of that was really targeted at trying to create more seamless systems for students between each sector. Among those were more than a dozen investments that we are working together to bring that coordination to bear. And as my colleague Ben noted in his last slide, it is absolutely critical that these efforts work in close coordination. In the Chief Education Office capacity as a coordinating agency, we have already set the stage for locally driven solutions by providing backbone support, capacity building, resources, and technical assistance for what we call cross-sector regional partnerships that work towards shared goals for our students. These regional achievement collaboratives that I'm referencing now have a statewide presence and are a group of partners that represent not only our educators at every level, but also individuals from industry, health, workforce development, and community-based organizations. Together, we think they drive the holistic strategies that are necessary. It isn't just educators. It's involving community organizations that work with families that help us make sure that those messages come through. We know already that many of our RACs that are at this confluence of school and institution and community are building some critical bridges. Most of them already have some action team steps that are already tackling the needs of high school students and looking at that transition to post-secondary and workforce. We think they're primed to provide additional support for these efforts. For example, the Southern Oregon Success RAC that spans Josephine, Jackson, and Klamath counties has already brought together their community members from multiple sectors to ensure that their high school youth are connected with the appropriate services and supports that are going to help them graduate and then transition to a career and or post-secondary education. And they did this by focusing their efforts together to conduct interviews at every high school in the three counties to identify the priority issues that students had as they were trying to move forward. And then they shared those results with the communities, really helping them see how assignment of a school team that's incorporating the community and the post-secondary partners can work together to connect students to those existing community supports. Similarly, with support from this fund, cross-sector groups could work together to strengthen the pivotal intersection of practice, where we see guidance counselors in high schools and the advising staff, they even use different terminology, at post-secondary work together. And I'm thrilled that we now are just getting ready to finalize welcoming a new lead specialist at the Oregon Department of Ed to focus specifically on college career readiness and counseling, because we have not had that voice at the state level saying, let's look at a framework for how our counselors can and need to support students and how they partner together with our cross sector groups. So I just wanted to bring those additional perspectives to your attention, and thank you again for your concerted efforts in this area of transition.
Thank you very much. Representative Mark Johnson, please. Good morning.
Is it still morning? Boy, these are long here, YouTube.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. and Co-Chair. Appreciate the time to just share a few information items about you, about the topic that you're talking about today. And for the record, I'm Mark Johnson from House District 52. I appreciate it. It's been great to be able to listen to the presentation today about the Senate Bill 418 work group. And I just want to fill you in on a bill that actually passed out of our House Higher Ed Committee unanimously last week, a bill of mine that is specifically targeted towards using a portion of that $6.8 million in a way to really enhance the success of our Oregon Promise students. As you all know, the interest in this program has been very large, very well received. Maybe 11,000 kids have filled out applications. It remains to be seen how many actually will receive the waiver and qualify. But nevertheless, we know there's a lot of kids that are going to be showing up next year, and hopefully these are kids that wouldn't have been showing up without the Oregon Promise. But we also know that we need them to be successful. As I was said when I was invited back to the White House to testify about this program in December, I said, you know, the easy part was passing the policy. The more difficult part is making sure that these students are going to become successful. And by successful, I mean getting to completion. Because, again, we're not advancing the agenda. We're not moving the ball, moving the needle at all, or really improving the dynamic if we don't get these kids to completion. We all know or recall the audit that we received about from the Secretary of State last year about our community college programs and how they really need more student support services. Our completion rate right now is not what it could be and what it should be. So therefore, throughout the whole interim period, my staff and I have been working on a plan to take a portion of that $6.8 million and focus it in a targeted effort. And that's what House Bill 4076 is about. I don't know what information you guys have available. Did you guys have the handout for the one pager, Doug? Is that available?
Yes,
okay. I don't need to go through the whole bill, but I just wanted to show you that we have put a plan together where $2.5 million can actually result in a four-year build-out of a student success initiative at all 20 colleges, and it's 20 because we're counting PCC as four. They're big enough. They don't want to be in, which is true. And I get that. But for that dollar value, we can put in place student support services that will mandate a first-year experience for every student, faculty development, helping them understand how to engage students in curriculum, in teaching, so we're not just simply lecturing at students, we're involving them in the learning, ensuring that there is in every campus there's a mentoring, tutoring type program in place, as well as other professional developments that are available. And this, the example that we use and the framework that we built off of was the Avid model. You've heard about Avid for high school. It's tremendously successful in where it's being used. Avid is also, there's an Avid for higher ed. So what we're doing in this plan here is not to mandate that colleges need to use Avid, because some schools like PCC have a Future Connect program that's doing very well. Others, like Mount Hood Community College, uses Avid. It's getting some tremendous results there. They can make their presentation to the HEC for their portion of these resources. They just have to show how they have specific outcomes attached to what they're doing is all. Gives them the flexibility to implement whatever they think, whatever is going to move the needle and implement these successful initiatives for our students. And it's important to point out that, again, Avid is a model that has tremendous outcomes, tremendous successes, but we don't want to tie the hands of the college presidents and say, you have to do this or you have to do that. So we presented our idea to the Student Success Task Force or work group that the colleges gather frequently to come together. There's representatives from all the colleges there. They're extremely supportive. The President's Council is very supportive of what we presented as well. So I just want you to know that that's out there. Again, as we talked about, we really need to get these pieces in place, and in place soon, because, again, September is coming quickly, and we're going to need that disbursement of funds. So, again, the bill has a referral to Ways and Means. I'm not exactly sure why, because there's not a new expenditure of assets. Really, it's between the HEC and the colleges that this relationship needs to take place. But, nevertheless, if that bill should come before you, we'll give you the full meal deal then, but I just wanted to make you know that there is a specific plan in place that I think has a little more structure to it than what we heard in the preceding report, that I think really fills the gap on what we're needing to have, so that whether you're attending a college in Treasure Valley or Coos Bay or wherever you're going, every student's going to have access to the same sort of success initiative, so that we can really begin to move the needle on student, not just attendance, but completion, as that's such a key component. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions or talk to you all offline. So appreciate that.
And if that bill should find its way to this committee, we will give it the full meal deal.
You bet. We'll be happy to, you know, come back at that time.
So, Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you saw the presentation today. Pretty much assigns all of the 6 points. So you're saying in there, there are places that the 2.5 should come out of if we're going to use, because it's coming from the same source. So
it does make sense
why it needs to come here. I mean, if we're going to look at the two, I think we've got to combine them at some point. Is there any particular part that you saw in the presentations where you would see this more likely?
Well, Senator Roblin, I would just say that I think that there could be some I think the buckets, if you will, of proposed expenditures are general enough. I think you could certainly fit this proposal within one of those. I mean, Avid is expressly called out in one of those recommendations. Other mentoring and student wraparound services are referred to, but in a more general, vague way. We're talking about a much more specific, intentional plan.
Okay. Anything else for the witness? Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry we didn't leave you more time.
We all learned something. Perfect job.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wilson.
Wednesday.
Wednesday is Umpqua Community College. We'll be here to both a building request as well as operating fund-related requests.
And as of now, next Monday?
Hopefully we won't have a meeting on Monday.
Okay.
I'll vote for that.
As of now, but Wednesday's meeting will be very important.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Appreciate those of you that were able to stay, and we're adjourned.
Talk about.
Oh, okay.
Unless you guys do, and we were thinking of F.
Oh, okay.
Unless you guys do, and we were thinking of F.